We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we will look at the changing nature of the American presidency. And our guest is presidential historian Robert Dallek. He is the author of a number of books about American presidents, including Nixon and Kissinger, that was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's written a book about John Kennedy, An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963. He's also written about FDR, Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, and Lyndon Johnson. His writing has appeared in many places, New York Times, Washington Post, The Atlantic, Vanity Fair. He makes his home in Washington, D.C. Now, while certainly it's true that all presidents arrive in the Oval Office with some ambitious agendas, those people also, today at least, seem to have much less power than those who came before. And our guest says it is this diminished capacity to shape events that will define this era of the presidency. We'll talk about that. Also try to talk a little bit about presidential temperament. What are the qualities that make for a good president? And why it is that some leaders rise to greatness while others fail? And questions certainly are welcome. We hope, though, that when people call in, they will try to be brief, just so we can keep moving and get as many callers in as possible. Questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. And you also may send your comments by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I do also want to mention, by the way, our guest's most recent book, which is titled The Lost Peace, Leadership in a Time of Horror and Hope, 1945-1953, which takes a look at the period right after the Second World War, when we're moving from that war into the Cold War, looking at some of the decisions world leaders made at the time and how it is that actually led to the Cold War. That book's just out, and it's published by Harper. And Dr. Dallek, hello.
Hello. Nice to be with you again.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it. We our attention was caught by a piece that appeared in the New York Times in September about the changing nature of the presidency. Mm-hmm. And it quoted a number of scholars, and you were one of them. And that's where I borrowed that quote that I mentioned here in the introduction. And it seems that the thrust of this piece is essentially that as the United States does not have the kind of dominance globally that it once did, that that also means that the president of the United States, whoever that person is, doesn't have the kind of power that past presidents have had. Am I essentially capturing the piece here?
Yeah, I think that's the case, that, you know, one feels a certain diminution of presidential control, influence, both at home and around the world, and one has the sense that, you know, that brief window when the Soviet Union collapsed and the United States remained as the only superpower, this is not to say that we don't remain as a great global influence, but there are rising challenges out there and certain frustrations. You know, the fact that we destroy the Iraqi armies so quickly, and yet we find it so difficult to control the direction of that country. You know, there still is there still are terrorist attacks, and there's still lots of controversy as to and question as to whether they're going to be able to sustain some kind of democratic constitutional system. The frustrations we have in dealing with Afghanistan. This morning's New York Times carries a story about the dispute, debate between American intelligence and military authorities as to the progress we're making in Afghanistan. Been there for 9 years. And so anyway, it all in all, it speaks to the whole sense of the limits of American power. You know, and brings us back to Vietnam and to the limited war we fought in Korea. And, you know, we're still wrestling with that dilemma in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
So there are frustrations and limitations that one sees.
This all seems to go to, it goes to globalization, both economically and otherwise. It goes to the power structure in the world today where there is no longer a single dominant power. And as we move forward, it seems there's the potential for it to be much more multipolar world. Do you think that this trend and the accompanying, these trends and the accompanying weakening of the presidency, is that something that is likely to be the case for the foreseeable future? Are we looking at a moment, or are we looking at a trend?
Well, you know, it's always very, very difficult to know. Arnold Toynbee, the great British English historian, said that the historian trying to understand the present is like the man with his nose pressed against the mirror trying to see his whole body. And so whether this is a momentary phenomenon or a trend that will develop into something more substantial over time is impossible to know. But there is the feeling that the country is in trouble, that there is a certain feeling of the inability of governing authority to shape things, both at home and abroad. You know, this nagging recession, the unemployment, and people are asking, have we entered into an era that will be like something the Japanese have passed through or still continue to wrestle with? You know, in the 1980s, there was all the talk about Japan becoming the number one industrial power in the world and was going to eclipse the United States, and then it went into this sort of economic funk, which it can't seem to reemerge from. You know, their stock market, I think, was at some point well over 30,000, and to this day is the average is somewhere around 10,000. And so it's there is a certain feeling of pessimism, which I think people have. And when you look at the polls, people feel the country is on the wrong track. And it's so at odds with what we experienced in 2008 when President Obama was running for office. And there was such a surge of hope, of optimism, of expectation that there was a better day coming. And here we are 2 years later, and there remains the sort of frustration and not hopelessness, I don't think it's that bad, but frustration that we had in the country when George W. Bush was coming to the end of his presidency.
Hmm. The new book, The Lost Peace, looks at, as I said, looks at this period after World War II.
Yes.
And the decisions that were made that led to the Cold War. And what we have here is a number of really quite capable leaders who made some very bad decisions.
Yes.
And if there is one, it seems to me, if there's one common factor here, it is overreach. And that makes me wonder, does that suggest that perhaps one of the biggest challenges any leader faces is recognizing the limits of his power?
Absolutely. And, you know, such a good example comes to mind for me with John F. Kennedy. And he, of course, increased the number of American advisors in Vietnam from roughly 600 to over 16,000. But he was very skeptical about the ability of the United States to send in a massive force and govern that peninsula, that country, that or several countries there, not just Vietnam, but what would happen in Cambodia and Laos. And he had such great doubts about that. And he saw the limits of power. And he was taught this lesson, I think, by the Bay of Pigs operation, the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs by the Cuban exiles in April of 1961, just a few months into Kennedy's presidency. And he was made so skeptical of using military power by the sort of advice he got from the CIA and his military, and he just was a man with a kind of wisdom about that, I think, and saw the limits of, and remember during that Vietnam War, the Senator Fulbright of Arkansas, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, spoke repeatedly about the limits of American power, and it's something we've wrestled with. We've had trouble learning, so to speak, and we see it again in the way in which we've been frustrated by Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm. We're getting in some questions here, so we'll get to some callers in a moment. Let me maybe ask one other question here at this point. Mm-hmm. Given that we know that the president, the power of the president over the U.S. economy is limited, over the global economy is limited, yeah. And we certainly, if there one thing that you can say for certain is that presidents will always have to deal with problems that they do not expect.
Yep.
Things, you know, you run, you say, this is what I would like to do, this is what I stand for, this is what I believe the job is all about. You get elected, and then you right. get smacked in the face with something that you would not have foreseen. So, yep. Given all of that, do you think that it's the case that that we're almost always going to be disappointed, or that we're going to wish for something in the president that that person may not have?
Well, you know, my teacher, my graduate studies was a man named Richard Hofstadter, and he once said, America is the only country in history that believes it was born perfect and strives for improvement. Well, you know, there is this quality that we are a hopeful people, a hopeful country. And in fact, and it's always more or less frustrated because I think maybe that our expectations are outrun the realities. But, you know, what I find so interesting currently is a poll I saw the other day that Gallup took of public sentiment about the last nine presidents going back to John Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked about approval, disapproval. Well, John Kennedy comes in number one, 85%. They've been doing this poll since 1990, and Kennedy always comes in at the top. Ronald Reagan was number two with 74%, and, you know, you move down from there. Well, it's so interesting to me that Kennedy and Reagan are the two presidents among the last nine who continue to have a kind of hold on the public's imagination. And I think what it mainly has to do with is the sense that people identify Kennedy and Reagan with hope, with optimism, with a kind of rhetoric that was so upbeat. Kennedy spoke of the new frontier, and Reagan, morning in America, the pride is back. And I think people so crave that, and I think your point is well taken, that inevitably there's a certain frustration. Because, you know, each new administration brings into office a sense of renewed hope, of optimism, of expectation, because that's the nature of the country, you know, the sort of frontier society, moving forward on the frontier, a better day ahead. And it seems inevitable that some of this will be frustrated. Of course, there are huge differences in degree. And what I always say is that, in part, significant part, it depends on the man. The Great Depression came along in the 1930s, and Herbert Hoover, who was president, proved to be a terrible failure at coping with it, not because anyone had clear answers to how to cure that depression. Franklin Roosevelt came into office, and he didn't cure the depression. It was, of course, the spending on World War II that really got us out of that economic funk. But the country responded so much more hopefully to Roosevelt because of Roosevelt's talents as a leader and his mastery of a kind of rhetoric. And Hoover didn't have that. Somebody said of Hoover, a rose would wilt in his hand. And Roosevelt, by contrast, as Churchill said, the first time you met him, it was like opening a bottle of champagne. So it's so important, this sort of personal connection that people feel to a president and their sense of hope and optimism. And the two current presidents, or two presidents in recent history, you give that to people, I think are clearly Kennedy and Reagan.
Yeah, I love that quote from Churchill. And it was just actually in preparing for this program that I came across that quote for the first time that he said about FDR. I think that's just wonderful. Our guest in this hour is presidential historian Robert Dalek, and he has written books about Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, and John Kennedy. His new book takes a look at the period right after World War II, where we moved from the war, the hot war, to the Cold War, and some of the decisions that were taken by the leaders of the time. The title of the book is The Lost Peace, and Harper is the publisher. Just out now. Questions welcome. And again, we hope people will try and be brief, just because we'd like to get as many different people in as possible. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you may also email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll start in here. We have a caller in Normal, line one. Hello.
Hello. Hey, yeah. Great show. Yeah, I think, so earlier you said the sense of trouble in the country with, like, our, like, people can't make a good decision to fix anything foreign, internationally, and then domestically. And I think it's because the leadership has been perhaps corrupted. They seem to lack accountability and stuff with all these, with, like, all the Goldman Sachs people rotating in and out of the government. Mm-hmm. And the president probably is one of these days going to be a former CEO of J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs or something. I mean, the ambassador to Netherlands, I heard, at one time, that Bush appointed or whatever, he used to be involved in these banking scandals and all this other, and subprime lending, and he ripped off all kinds of people. And there he is. He's an ambassador.
Yes.
But I like Kennedy. I'd like to ask about the validity of what I heard. You go to Wikipedia, they have it there. But Kennedy refused to sign Operation Northwoods. Was that true? Do you know what that is? And could you tell us about it? Thank you.
Well, you tell me about it. What are you referring to?
I'm afraid the caller has rung off, so I don't know.
Well, you know, what I would mention in response to his comments is that so much of the problem, political problem, I think, in this country has to do with you know, money and the flow of money into the political system. Look at the hundreds of millions of dollars that were spent on the last presidential campaign and then this current congressional campaign. And, you know, it seems to me, maybe I'm a purist, but the money is a corrupting influence. And it does have such an important influence on the way in which our politics operate. And who was it? Jesse Unruh, who was the treasurer of the state of California for a while back in the 60s and sort of a master politician, said that the money is the mother's milk of politics. And I'm afraid it remains so to this day, but it has a certain corrupting influence, and it makes it very difficult for, I think, all sorts of people in high office to think first about the well-being. I mean, they all say they do, and they may even think they do, but behind this so often is the old adage that a politician's first goal is to be elected, his second goal is to be reelected. And how do you do that? Well, part of it is you got to have those funds to advertise yourself and your ideas and your attributes on radio and television.
You sort of wonder most, I think that is the case, that at least recently most presidents have either come from the Congress or they have been governors.
Yes.
One wonders, well, what's the potential for someone coming to the presidency who has never held elected office before, from you know, whatever field, somebody who was in business or so forth? Do you think that that's something that's at all likely?
Well, it's certainly very possible. You know, we've had some business leaders who reached for high office. They haven't made it, and Ross Perot, for example, in recent history, but they are an important element in this society, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be any more ineffective or any more corrupt or unprincipled than anyone else who runs for the office of president or senate or member of the House of Representatives. But I think everything is possible in terms of our political system. It's a very fluid system in that sense. After all, the fact that Barack Obama was able, the first African Americans to reach the highest office, and I would imagine we're going to see a woman as president in the not too distant future. So there is a huge pool of potential candidates out there, and some of them are in the business world.
Let us talk with someone else. This is a caller in Champaign, and line number two. Hello.
Oh, very good. You've mentioned so far names of most presidents that I'm kind of interested in. The one that might be connected yet, but at a distance, would be Wilson, where in 1918, Wilson and Churchill set up this imaginary country of Iraq so that we could have dissident fighting individual groups of governors not able to control our exploitation of their oil.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that European colonialism seems to have simply continued through American diplomacy? And why is it that so many of our presidents and office holders are simply English princelings like Dole, Bush, and even kind of with Obama as a British whipping boy, operating our war-making experiences through the world so that we can exploit natural resources throughout the world?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting point you're making, which is that, in a sense, we've become the inheritors of Western imperialism or colonialism, because we have this powerful anti-colonial tradition. But it's been contradicted repeatedly, first, you know, with the Spanish-American War, when we acquired a colonial empire, despite the fact that we had this long tradition of hating imperialism. And of course, we had something called the Northwest Ordinance of 1794, which said that any territory that we brought under our control would eventually be brought into the Union as an equal state. And of course, that's not been fully honored over time because, we had Puerto Rico. It's not a fully equal state, or places like possessions like Guam. So we've sort of been drawn into this through the acquisition of our power, our might. You know, there's a very interesting book that was published a year or two ago now by a man named James Sheehan, who's the German historian at Stanford University, and it's called Where Have All the Soldiers Gone? And his argument in that book is that Europe has gone from Mars to Venus, and the United States has gone from Venus to Mars. His point being that the Europeans came to understand how impermissible these conflicts on the European continent were, that resulted in such horrors as World Wars I and II. And, you know, to tell a personal anecdote, not long ago I had lunch with a French attorney who was in town, was interested in some of my writing. We met for lunch. And in the course of the conversation, I asked him if he had children. He said, yes, he had a son and a daughter who were in their 20s. And I said, well, how do they think of themselves? And he said, well, of course, as French, but also as Europeans, that they had friends in Holland and Spain and Britain, Germany, Italy. And I said, could your children ever imagine a war now between France and Germany? He said, oh, absolutely not. Well, what a change this is from, you know, the first half of the 20th century, when the Europeans, the French and the Germans, they fought to what became two world wars. Well, we now have sort of inherited this these responsibilities and seem to have this global position. And remember Dwight Eisenhower's caution against the military-industrial complex. He was concerned. He was worried. And rightly so, because the burden of our defense spending. So with our expanded power and with the decline of European power influence, we seem to have inherited these issues referring to, I guess, imperialism and militarism.
Well, I'm really struck, was really struck by a piece, though, that you wrote for Foreign Policy recently. It published in November. If people want to read it, they can read it online, in which you seem to be arguing that one of the great mistakes that American leaders have made is allowing themselves to be captured or captivated by this idea that the United States is this colossus astride the world, and that we are the leading light of peace, freedom, and democracy as we define it, and that it is our right. We have the power. It is indeed our divine mission to go around the world making the world safe for democracy. And you seem to be making the argument that's gotten us into trouble again and again, and it's something that we've got to let go of.
Yes, exactly. I think you state the points very well. And, you know, in 1950, there was an article published in Harper's Magazine by a British historian, Dennis Brogan, and the article was called The Illusion of American Omnipotence. And, of course, we were then caught in the Korean War, and that, I think, brought it home to us so powerfully because we were so frustrated by that limited war and our inability to work our will and topple that North Korean regime. And, of course, we have echoes of this problem to this very moment. And I've often thought that the Brogan article could have also been entitled The Omnipotence of American Illusion, and the extent to which we hang on to these grandiose notions about how far our influence reaches. And it's just, you know, we can't control the world. We can't police it. We can't dominate. To the fact that we have nuclear weapons, because as the great diplomat George Kennan, who wrote about this so penetratingly, I think, published a book called The Nuclear Delusion. And what he said was that these are not weapons that are usable. They're weapons of mass destruction. He said they should have been thought of as the way we thought about poison gas after World War I. Nuclear weapons can't be used on a battlefield, because if you use them, you're not only going to kill your enemy, you're going to kill your own forces. And so he thought they should be barred. And, of course, there are leaders, recent secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, people like former Senator Sam Nunn and Henry Kissinger, who would talk about the abolition of these hydrogen bombs, these nuclear weapons. Now, it's problematical as to whether we're ever going to put the genie back in the bottle, because we're certainly not going to do it while places like countries like North Korea and Iran are building or trying to build nuclear arsenals. So it's a dilemma. But, you know, finding leaders, statesmen, who can balance the realities and lead in more thoughtful and considered ways, it's always a challenge for a democracy like ours.
Well, you know, I think back to when President Bush, the last President Bush, was first running, and he said that he didn't think that the United States should be engaged in nation building.
Exactly.
Well, of course, we know what happened. We had 9/11. We had Iraq. We had Afghanistan. Now, assuming that when he said he didn't think that the country should be engaged in nation building, assuming that he was sincere when he said that, this again perhaps goes back to the earlier point of you say one thing, but then you get in there, and who knows what happens.
That's right.
So, do you though then, as a as we're thinking about the kind of person that we would like to have as president, is it better to have someone who at least initially seems to be a person of somewhat limited ambition, or should we go with a person who seems to have the grand vision?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the vision. What is the vision, and how realistic are they about implementing it? You know, you can't have, I don't think, someone running for that highest office who is not a visionary. Franklin Roosevelt said in his first inaugural, without, quoting from the Bible, without vision, the people perish. And a president has to be part visionary. But it depends so much on how realistic this vision is and how pragmatic they are implementing it. You know, this current administration, President Obama, struggles with the fact that on the one hand he is a visionary who thinks in terms of more prosperous economy and a society in which there is health insurance for the great bulk, if not everyone in the population. How do you go about getting there? And, you know, and he has been, and we see now that he's struggling with his own party over questions of dealing with the deficits and the tax cuts and spurring the economy forward. So this is the art of governance, and it's so difficult to know, and I think your point is so well taken, that you just never know what's going to happen. Running for office is one thing. Governing, of course, is another. And it's hugely influenced by what happens at the time the individual holding the office has power. And then the challenges, I think Churchill said, a crisis is an opportunity. And some presidents, as I said before, like a Franklin Roosevelt, carry off very well. You know, I think of the comparison between Theodore Roosevelt and William Howard Taft. They both faced very similar conditions, and we see T.R. as one of the great or near great presidents in American history, and Taft as largely a failure. So I think it had a lot to do with the men and the way in which they responded to the challenges of their day. But it's so difficult to predict who will be most adept at handling those challenges. And you don't even know what the challenges will be, as you were saying before.
Our guest in this hour is presidential historian Robert Dalek. He has written about many presidents, FDR, Truman, Reagan, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, John Kennedy. His new book is The Lost Peace, which takes a look at the origins of the Cold War. It's just out from Harper. Questions are welcome. We have a number of them. We're already past our midpoint, so we'll try to get in as many as we can and go next, I believe, to someone in Hoopston, who is on a cell phone, I think, line 4. Hello?
Yeah, David, thanks. I hope you guys can hear me okay. I'm on a cell phone.
Yeah, go ahead.
Great show. You guys touched on a lot of the things I was going to discuss, but I have a couple of observations for your guests, and I'll make them and ring off, and he can comment. I do agree with the money situation. There's a saying in this country that money doesn't talk in America, it screams. Huh. And I think with the vast amount of money and the small fraction of people who control the money, I think it's somewhat delusional. I mean, most people are just working to stay alive, and there's a whole other ball game out there that most people aren't even ever exposed to. But there was a saying by John F. Kennedy, and I can't quote it exactly, but he said the vast amount of representatives represent the special interest because of the money, and it's up to the president to be the voice of the people, of the common man. I just was wondering. Well, I'm wondering two things. Number one, if you think that's still true, and number two, kind of a counterfactual. I'm a great fan of JFK, but as a president, he was somewhat ineffective. And, of course, when he was assassinated, martyred, of course, then his star rose quite a bit. But I was wondering if he played his term out, I just was wondering where he would be in history, not given his assassination. I do agree. You know, a lot of it has to do with the place and time that the person is president. Bill Clinton took credit for the expansion of the economy, but you know, who's to say would not that expansion had taken place if somebody else was in power? And like for Jimmy Carter, he was somewhat ineffective and held in low esteem as president. Now I think his star has risen quite a bit. So I think that all plays a fact. Very interesting. I'll go ahead and ring off and let you comment. Thanks.
Sure. Well, you know, as far as John F. Kennedy goes, as I said before, there was a kind of wisdom to the man. You're also quite correct. He didn't get in the domestic arena, he didn't get very much accomplished. He had four great large congressional initiatives that were on the table when he died, a big tax cut to spur the economy, federal aid to education and Medicare law, and, of course, civil rights to bring an end to segregation in all places of public accommodation. Now, if he had lived, I think he certainly would have been reelected. He was quite popular in 1963, and I think if Goldwater had been his opponent, as Johnson faced Goldwater, I think Kennedy would have won easily, a bigger landslide, as Johnson did. And I think then he would have also had with him this substantial liberal majority in the Congress, the House and Senate, and I think he would have been able to pass his four big initiatives. But, you know, I don't think he would have been as aggressive about the domestic programs as Johnson was. And Johnson, although, did seize on Kennedy's talk about a war on poverty and put that into action. I think Kennedy would have gotten those major legislative initiatives passed, and I think on Vietnam he would have been different from Johnson. He was skeptical about too much escalation there. It's true, he increased the number of advisors from, as I said, about 600 to over 16,000, but he had grave doubts about sending in massive numbers of land troops who he thought might get caught there in a quagmire. And so we would have seen a different America, a different world, if he had lived. But these are the counterfactuals, the what-have-beens, the might-have-beens. We'll never know, of course, and we'll never know exactly what Kennedy would have done. And also, it gets back to the point we were making before. I don't think Kennedy himself knew exactly what he would have done, because he would have been responding to the circumstances. I love the quote from Herbert Hoover about Franklin Roosevelt during the 1932 campaign. He said, "This fellow Roosevelt is a chameleon on plaid." And, that's exactly what he was, a chameleon on plaid, changing coloration, changing shape, form. He was the great pragmatist. He himself said he was like the quarterback on a football team. He'd try one play. If it didn't work, he would try something else, and he'd move on. And that's what it takes. But on the other hand, you don't want to be seen as an opportunist. You see, people in this country, I think, they're sympathetic to a pragmatic president who's responding to the changing realities. But if you come across as an opportunist, then it's very destructive to your political influence or control. You know, the presidency is such a difficult job. Thomas Jefferson said it's a splendid misery, and our presidents are both our kings and our prime ministers. They both carry the symbols of office and also the administrative responsibilities. It's, frankly, I sometimes wonder why anyone ever wants to do the job. But there are plenty of candidates who would love to get there.
We have about 10 minutes left. We have some other callers. We'll talk next with someone in Montgomery, and this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, you're bringing up a lot of good topics, and thank you again, David, for having the program on and your guest. My big thing is I think you could solve a lot of problems would be, and this is my opinion, take the money aspect out of the election issue. I think right now, and everybody pretty much knows this or can see this, rich people are the only ones who can run for office. Third-party candidates or anybody other than the two big parties cannot run because it's physically and you know, just economically impossible to run. And it's kind of an unfair advantage because I think, in my opinion, that the little guy like myself and you guys have been left out a lot of this stuff. Like I say, if you pay somebody $10,000, he'll listen to you. If you pay him $10, you know, you're going to get $10 worth of nothing.
Right.
And it's hard for me, as an American citizen, to understand why this is. I thought this country is built on the values of the American citizen, and now it just seems to be all about money. And, you know, regardless of who has been in office and who might be in office, I think the last 30, 40, 50 years, I want to say the last half a decade, has been wrong with this – half a century, I mean, has been wrong with this country. I don't think there's ever been a better president than John F. Kennedy since then. And I think a lot of these guys just, you know, blow with the wind. Political point of view might be, this partisan bickering has got to stop, and the American people see this. And I don't understand why they just don't listen.
Let's get I appreciate your comments, and I want to get a comment from Professor Dalek. And I guess one of the things that interests me is that how it is, you know, the president has to sell himself as a man of the people. But when you take a look at the background of people who have come to the presidency, even John Kennedy,
of course,
he was not exactly your average guy. You know, he was born into the aristocratic class to the extent that we have one in this country.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, you're quite right. I mean, of course, Kennedy was born to the purple, and so much of his political career was shaped by the fact that his father was one of the richest men in the United States, if not in the world, and was able to put an awful lot of money into his first his house and then his Senate and his presidential campaign. So money does talk very loudly, and I wish, as the gentleman was suggesting, I wish there were public funding of campaigns. But, you know, this is may take a constitutional amendment to change this, because the argument from the court is that this is free speech. This is a matter of speech. Money is speech. And I don't quite buy it, but that's what the courts argue. And I, as I said before, I fear that it does have a certain corrupting influence on our politics. And he's right that, if somebody's giving you $10,000 as opposed to $10, who are you going to be listening to? Who will have the greater influence? And so, yeah, special interests are a powerful force in this country and our politics. And sadly, that Supreme Court decision that recently allowed the corporations and labor unions to put ever more money into our politics and there's a certain hidden quality to it now as well. So it's distressing. So maybe someday the country will wake up and get an amendment to the Constitution that says political campaigns should be a matter of public financing, and it makes for greater egalitarianism and greater opportunity for the people to run who don't have the sort of money that someone like a Ross Perot had to promote a campaign for himself.
We'll try to get into at least one more caller. This is Chicago, line two. Hello.
Good morning. You know, I find it interesting. Some presidents, how they are perceived in public and how they are in private, for instance. President Kennedy, if you talk to the African-American population, he's up there with Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
But yet you don't realize that it was President Johnson.
Yep.
They got the Civil Rights Bill passed. They got the Voting Rights Act passed.
Yep.
That declared war on poverty, and I just thought it was interesting.
Well, you're absolutely right. Johnson is undervalued, I feel, and Kennedy is I mean, you know, I admire Kennedy. He was a very astute and in many ways effective president. But, you know, there was a recent Gallup poll, and I mentioned this before, asking people about the last nine presidents go back to Kennedy. Kennedy, number one, 85%. Ronald Reagan, number two, 74%. LBJ came in seventh with only a 49% approval rating and 51% disapproval. And the shadow of Vietnam still hangs so heavily over the Johnson presidency, because in terms of domestic change and social legislation, nobody had a greater impact than Johnson, except for Franklin Roosevelt. And those Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, I mean, it changed this country, in a huge way, and for the good, because there was such terrible oppression and inequality and distortion of our democracy. Yeah. So, and Johnson, the Deep South Texas senator, was the one who was able to do it. So, but you know, the public's memory is short. What I often think is, do people remember that Theodore Roosevelt set up the National Park System or the Food and Drug Administration? Do they know that the Federal Reserve System came from the Wilson administration, or that FDR was the architect of Social Security, Johnson of Medicare and civil rights? And, you know, the beat goes on. But I think what they remember are the personal traits of presidents and their inspirational rhetoric. This is what I think holds them fast.
Well, just for and I'm really, I wish we could go another hour. There are many other things that I would like to ask you, but just on this point of temperament. Say, when you think about someone like Lyndon Johnson,
yeah.
Here you think about a man who, if he wanted something from you, he would grab you by the lapels,
yep.
Almost literally would grab you by the yep. lapels and would be in your face about it.
Yeah.
One of the criticisms that's often made of Barack Obama is that he's someone who is too cool, too
yep.
controlled,
yeah, too
not
passive.
Emotional, too
yeah.
passive. And so that makes me wonder about emotionality as a character trait in presidents, and whether does that, if we think that the person is, you know, is likely to get in there and start swinging, either literally or metaphorically, do we think that's a good quality, or
yeah.
Do we appreciate someone who we think, if there's a crisis, they're going to be cool? How do we think about those things?
Well, I think it depends on the circumstances that one sees the individual operating in. Remember, after the Oklahoma City bombing, Bill Clinton scored a lot of points with people in this country with the speech he made about how this is not what Americans do, this is not how we behave, and it resonated brilliantly with millions and millions of people in this country. So again, it gets back to your point about how the particular circumstances and the crisis or the events that a president faces and how he handles them. And, of course, that is a lot of that in any presidential campaign. You know, how do they come across in one of these debates? You know, Nixon and Kennedy, when they debated the first time on television, people who heard it on the radio thought that Nixon probably won, and the great bulk of people watched it on television, and they thought Kennedy had won. And so temperament, demeanor, it's very important. And given the extent of the media coverage these days, you know, the 24/7 news cycle and all the media outlets on the Internet and cable television, and, I mean, I had dinner with other historians with President Obama, and we asked him, how do you deal with these things, this constant barrage of a kind of attention, a lot of which is not very constructive or appealing. And but you know, you're quite right. He's cerebral, he's thoughtful, but you know, he's also been remembered during the campaign. He became very assertive and inspirational with the kind of rhetoric and emotion that he showed. And so it's a fascinating business. That's why I'm interested in presidential history and presidents, because I find it's a source of constant interest and a challenge to understand.
Well, real quick, we're now at a point where there are a lot of Democrats and liberal commentators that are not happy with the president because of the deal that he worked with the Republicans in Congress to get the extension of unemployment in exchange for the extension of the Bush tax cuts. And we have some people, as I say, some people on the left, commentators on the left, that seem to be about ready to say this is a failed presidency. Well, he's only halfway through the first term. So you wonder, well, can you really say much at this point about how things are going to end up?
No, because, you know, look at Harry Truman, 1946, took a terrible drubbing in those congressional elections. And by 1948, he was able to overcome the odds against him, a divided Democratic Party on the left, on the right, he in the center, so to speak, and he won that election. It was a brilliant upset over Tom Dewey. And then you look at Ronald Reagan, 1982, a majority of people in this country said they didn't want him to run again for president because the country was in an economic funk. And by 1984, he won a landslide. So, you know, I wouldn't bet a nickel on where things are going to be in 2012. The economy makes a comeback. The job situation is moving in the right direction. Obama could win a landslide,
all
but
right.
He could also be defeated. We don't know.
Well, we must stop at that point. Our guest, Robert Dalek, he's a presidential historian. If you'd like to read some of his books, you just head to the bookstore or the library, look for some of his books. He's written about Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, John Kennedy. His new book is The Lost Peace, Leadership in a Time of Horror and Hope, 1945-1953. It's published by Harper. And thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.